This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering the largest selection of audiobooks for your smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
I'm Jeff Combs. I'm everywhere on Star Trek, and you keep tuning in to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 185, Space Mystery Inc. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Daniel Prue. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including the first major update to the Star Trek Encyclopedia in 16 years, leaked photos from the next film, and who we think the Star Trek Beyond villain might be. Then in the feature, we're joined by Jarrah Hodge and Zachary Frühling to discuss the TNG episode, Devil's Due. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Daniel. It's great to have you back here with me on the Ready Room. It's been quite a while since you've been here, but although I'm glad to have you back, I am a little disappointed. I thought you were going to bring Commander Flipper with you.
The thing is, Commander Flipper's apparently biodome that he lives in doesn't fit through the door. So okay. I had to just come by myself.
So in Earl Grey 100, you guys did the role-playing game, and Commander Flipper has a really big role. And of course, Commander Flipper, as those who listen to this show know, is a crew member who was created here on the Ready Room years ago because of Cetacean Ops. So when you guys were preparing that, was there a mandate that like Commander Flipper has to be in this story?
You know, I'm going to give 1,000% credit to my co-host Philip Gilfus, who wrote the entire episode and the entire adventure and didn't tell me and Darren anything about it. In fact,
didn't know either?
No.
Going in?
I didn't, like, we had heard rumblings, but we didn't even know there were going to be other people on the episode.
Oh, really?
Philip was like, we're going to do something special and, you know, we'll get into it. So
when you guys recorded, even then, you and Darren did not know that the rest of us had recorded lines?
Oh, no. No, absolutely not. No.
Oh, really? That's cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it wasn't even until I got into the actual chat that I saw that there were other people there. And then he started playing these clips from all the other people on the network. It was really fantastic. And again, like I said, all the credit to Philip Gilfus for writing it, orchestrating it, coordinating it. It was amazing. And then to have Char play Commander Flipper was brilliant. And it was one of the highlights of many highlights of that episode. Everybody, please listen to our Earl Grey 100 episode. Even if you don't like TNG, if you like Trek FM, you will like that episode. I guarantee it. It was so much fun.
Yeah, I love Shore's Commander Flipper. I love the attitude that Commander Flipper has.
So. It was great. It was so much fun.
All right. And for some reason, I got to play Geordi. I don't know. I thought I was recording a voiceover for a Microsoft PowerPoint commercial. Yeah. Turns out that I was recording Geordi's part for this story.
I think it's just because, you know, you love PowerPoint, just like Geordi, and that, you know, that makes sense, right? You're just such a huge fan of PowerPoint.
That's right. I love it.
I love it.
Okay, well, let's talk about a couple of news things here, and then later we're going to be joined by Jarrah Hodge from Women at Warp and Zachary Frühling, our associate producer here on the show, to talk about Devil's Due. Before that, I am so excited about this story, Daniel. I can barely control myself. The Star Trek Encyclopedia is going to be updated finally. Mike and Denise Okuda are working on this project with Becker and Meyer, the publisher. they're going to update this book, which was last updated in 1999. This thing, of course, right now has no Enterprise, and I think Voyager stops at the end of season 2 or 3, something like that. I forget the exact season, actually, but it ends very early in Voyager, and so there's so much Star Trek after that. And I've been waiting and waiting and waiting, and when they did the digital release a couple of years ago as the ebook, I thought maybe they'll update it then, and they didn't. But fans everywhere study this book, and I certainly have, and I'm sure you have. So how excited are you about this, Daniel?
I mean, you know, you're right. Like, come on. It's been years and years. And like, honestly, I'm going to take maybe a little bit of a different track here and just say we Star Trek fans are so hungry. We are so hungry for anything. Like, we are like salivating for the idea of an updated 1999 Star Trek encyclopedia. Like, honestly, this is the first thing that struck me. We can get all this information. We can get these pictures. We can find all of this stuff on the internet. But we are so excited about this book because we are like, we just want anything. Just give us, just please, anything. Just please, well, give it to us.
Maybe it's me being someone who used to use the reference books before everything was on the internet, you know, before there was a Memory Alpha. So even though now, yes, I will go online and I'll get this information, I loved this book so much, and I was so frustrated that it was never updated year after year after year, that just the mere fact that they're finally going to put in the effort, and I don't mean Mike and Denise, because I'm sure Mike and Denise would have loved to have updated this at any point in the past, but you know, you need a publisher behind it, it needs to be funded, and so all the pieces have to come together. The fact that it's finally getting the attention, it's just kind of like, finally, finally, this book is going to get the attention that it deserves, and it's going to get updated. It's just like I wish that they would do a new Voyager companion, which actually told you something, like the way the DS9 companion or the TNG companion does, and I wish there were an Enterprise companion as well. I love seeing that the books still get some love somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, I'll get the book. I mean, I'm definitely going to get this book, and I'm interested to see it. Because, like, at the very least, these books are catalysts for these creatives to come in and talk and tell us new things that has never been told before, or to show us interesting. Mm-hmm. Maybe they have pictures that they have never released before. Then maybe there's something, some interesting anecdote about whatever. Like, it's going to be amazing. It's going to be incredible. It's just the fan reaction to me was very striking in the fact that, like, please, this is what we just give us more Star Trek. Come on. 3 years in between movies is not enough. Just give us more Star Trek. And this is the ultimate version of that, because this is all of Star Trek, right? This is all encompassing, and like, we're going to eat it up and we're going to love it. Now I'm very excited about it. What really actually kind of interests me, an interesting note, is at least, I'm not sure if this is the final cover art or what they're going to use or not, but from what I understand is, so the cover art features the Delta Shield from the JJ movies. And I think what I heard, and correct me if I'm wrong, Chris, is that the JJ movies are going to be kind of in an appendices. Is that right? Like, or like, kind of stuck in the back of the book somewhere? Or
think,
what's going on?
I mean, I heard that there would be JJ stuff in there because that is Star Trek. It's official. But I don't know exactly how they're going to place it in the book.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe that's been said somewhere and I haven't seen it, but...
Yeah, I actually like the fact that they're embracing it on the cover. Yeah.
You don't need a lot of space for that because there are only two movies. So.
No, of course. No, yeah. Of course not. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. In the same way that you'd probably need just as much space for that as you would for, say, the Mirror Universe, right? Where it's just a few episodes. So,
yeah.
You know, the same kind of a thing. That's all.
So the price point on this is going to be $100. Does that turn you off at all?
It's a lot of money. It's a lot of money for a book in an age when I don't buy books. I mean, you know, but it's a coffee table book, right? That's the idea.
It's a two-volume hardcover.
Yeah. So initially, yes, it does actually set, honestly, I'll be honest, it sets me off from the price. But I know what I'm getting is quality material, and I'm still going to buy it.
Yeah. And it'll probably sell for like $50 or $60 on Amazon, I bet. So I'm going to buy it. I'm looking forward to it. It's going to have nearly 300 pages of new text and illustrations, which is going to be amazing. As an Enterprise fan, I'm really excited to see Enterprise actually represented in this big reference book that people turn to. It also says it's going to have a design overhaul, which I'm really happy about because I do think that the existing Star Trek, the Encyclopedia is not the easiest book to look at. You know, it could be cleaner as a designer, as a typesetter and a publisher. I think it could be produced a little bit more nicely than it originally was. So I'm glad to see that. And it's not going to be out till fall of 2016 though. So we've got to wait a little over a year, but the fact that they can go back, they must already be working very hard on it because a year, if they can get all of this stuff cataloged and into the book and get it printed and out there in 1 year, I think that's a pretty big feat. So maybe this is going to be the main project for Mike and Denise for the next year.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it'll be interesting. It's a good solid 50th anniversary kind of side project for Star Trek for sure. I think a lot of people will appreciate it for that reason.
Of course, an even better side project for the 50th anniversary would be a TV series. CBS,
if you're listening. Wait, so we're going to talk about the announcement about Star Trek 2016 right now, right, Chris?
Oh, no, we're not supposed to talk about that, Daniel.
Sorry.
But what we will talk about instead is Star Trek Beyond and the images that have leaked. You knew this was going to happen, right? There were some images that were going to get out there. The space paparazzi were able to take a shot of Sophia Boutella in her alien makeup. And a video actually went up on YouTube before Paramount made a copyright claim and it got pulled down, obviously. And then the site that broke it, Screen Crush, they made some animated GIFs of it. So the video is not there anymore, but now there's animated GIFs. But I'm just looking at a still shot. And she's an interesting looking alien, a little bit Borgish looking, perhaps. But you had a really interesting theory, Daniel, that we talked about.
Yeah, so if you haven't seen the pictures, you should go check them out because I'm not going to do them justice by describing them.
Go to Trek Movie, go to 1701 News. They have the pictures up there.
But it is it's this woman is in standard, I would say standard sci-fi kind of garb. The outfit's not spectacular, but she's got white hair. She's all of her makeup isn't white, but she has black lines down the front of her face. And I'm thinking, what if this is the classic TOS episode? Because I can never remember episode titles, so let's just be real here. You know, with the half black, half white aliens.
Let that be your last battlefield.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you very much. This might be the updated versions of them, right? So we see this woman, who's apparently a major character here in this movie. Maybe she's the whiter version of that alien, and we get one that has the reverse colors, where they're a black skinned with white stripes. And
they have the white stripes on. So it's like it's an updated "Let That Be Your Last Battlefield" for the 21st century.
Exactly. It's they're just stripes, so you know it's hip.
Or maybe they went back, they finally made peace on that planet, and now they all look like this after they combine. Yeah.
I like that idea.
That way, you don't have, you know, the racial issue anymore that you had in that episode, because now they all have the look that Sophia Boutella has here, and they're all happy and at peace with each other.
You know, and they also do have a little bit of flavor of the primitive aliens on the beginning planet of Into Darkness. So I wonder, I don't think that it'll be related to that at all, but that would be interesting.
Yeah. Although, just looking at it right now, does have a little bit of a Borgish feel to it.
I would lose my Star Trek stuff if it was Borg related. I mean, I know a lot of people really hate the idea of doing that kind of a thing. I would, my mind would be blown. Like,
and so you would love it if they did
that. Oh, I would love it, absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
In the same way that, like, it's actually something I've never really heard people really delve into, because Into Darkness is kind of a conflicted film. A lot of people like it, a lot of people hate it, you know, whatever. But the introduction of Section 31, which is a super, like, very inside Star Trek kind of a thing, I thought that was one aspect of the movie that worked really well. And in the same way, the Borg could, like, the Borg on a big budget, big screen, even bigger budget than First Contact, would be really interesting. And I would really like to see Kirk versus the Borg. You know, that would be fun to see too. So,
yeah, I think my feeling on that would be, I don't want to see the Borg because I really, really want to see them do something original with these movies. And if they bring in the Borg, well, here they are once again, just falling back on something very familiar. On the other hand, it does take place in an alternate timeline, so there's no reason why Kirk couldn't encounter the Borg in the 23rd century. It's not going to violate anything because the timeline's different at this point. So they could do it and they could justify it. And then as fans, you could justify it by saying that, well, something happened and the Borg came to the Alpha Quadrant and they came to Earth in the 23rd century in this timeline. But so, creatively, I'd really like to see them do something different.
So, Chris, then let's you know, a year away out from this film or even more at this point?
Less than a year if they get it out on schedule.
Yeah, 9 months, 11 months.
Yeah.
Place your bets now. This alien character, is she a young Borg queen?
That's a good question, because I could see her, like, in her youth. She's a little more rebellious. So these are tattoos that she had put on her face. She's got her, you know, her hair pulled back. Got a little style going there. It's quite possible. It's quite possible. Although, you know, in Star Wars, the Emperor, like in Return of the Jedi, had very white skin like this as well, right? And in this photo, it looks like there's a tiny AT-AT coming towards her. So could this be some kind of J.J. Abrams Star Trek, Star Wars crossover going on here?
I don't know of a concept.
Could this be the Emperor's sister?
The Emperor's sister. I literally don't know of a concept that would kill more nerds than a Star Wars, Star Trek crossover. I think there would just be a sweeping heart attack, a nerd heart attack across the globe.
What if Keenzer got a buddy who was a hobbit?
I'm going on an adventure!
Chris, let's stop. you're playing in dangerous waters here, Chris. Let's just stop. Can we talk about, in these pictures that have been released too, Chris Pine's uniform, his new uniform?
Yeah, that one's interesting. It almost feels like an Enterprise type uniform to me, like maybe something that, maybe a Commodore's uniform, if you kind of let that evolve a little bit.
Yeah.
What do you think about it? You got big colored, I guess, well, those are the colors. So the other uniforms would be red and blue up there on the top, on the shoulders, right?
Yeah. I mean, there are pictures. If you see this blue kind of jumps, this, well, not a jumpsuit, really. They have a jacket and pants. And Chekhov is wearing the same uniform as Kirk. So what in my mind, I think I see four colored something and I think pips, but they're not pips because Chekhov is wearing the same one. But I don't know. It feels very discount Star-Lord from Guardians of the Galaxy in a lot of ways.
Yeah, or Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah, exactly.
Especially the original Battlestar Galactica. Mm-hmm. The jackets that they had.
It does seem pretty practical.
Except they would be brown, but yeah.
But I don't know, you know, we'll have to see, but it's just, and maybe a little bit of shades of Picard's gray jacket kind of in there as well. Of course, that's.
Oh, but Picard's gray jacket was way cooler than this.
I agree wholeheartedly.
Yeah.
But I do like that they have a side pocket for their tricorder. They have a side pocket for their communicator, and they have the leg holster for the phaser as well.
Right. Well, you know, they've been watching some Enterprise and they figured out you need pockets. You got to put this stuff somewhere. So, Yeah, that's interesting. And of course, they've got the Starfleet patch on the shoulder. That's been floating around in pictures for quite some time now. And I know a lot of fans are really excited about that. I'd actually like to have one of those patches myself. Put it on my bag.
Yeah.
My official Starfleet bag.
I honestly, as kind of, I don't know, I wouldn't say no to one of those jackets, honestly. Like, I would wear it. I would wear it out.
Well, it's interesting to see these photos. And you know what's funny, too, is I don't know how you feel about this, but I remember when First Contact was coming out, and I went to extreme measures to make sure I saw nothing and heard nothing about the film because I wanted to be surprised when I went to the theater. I did not want to know what the new Enterprise was going to look like or anything. And then, of course, I remember pulling up to pump gas into my car, and there was a Star Trek promotion going with the gas station. And right on top of the pump was just the Enterprise E on this giant cardboard thing. Really frustrated me. But otherwise, I avoided everything. And with these movies, I'm like, yeah, show me the pictures. Let me see what's going on. I'm like, I just don't care. I'm like, just let me see. Do you feel that way too?
Yeah, you know, I'm actually generally not one that cares about spoilers. In the words of a famous Star Trek character, it's not about the destination, it's about the journey. So I don't really care to hear about the big spoilers of a movie. If they killed Uhura or they killed Scotty in the next movie, it wouldn't bother me to know that right now. It's more important about how that happens in the context.
Right. You don't know how it happens.
So I don't really care. Yeah. So these kinds of things don't bother me. I just, honestly, it feels like I remember being really frustrated with Into Darkness and really frustrated that they were being super secretive about it. And I'm not getting that sense with this film. And I don't know what it is about it, because I don't think they're really being more open about this movie. I just don't. Maybe Into Darkness colored me in a way that I just don't really think about it that much. I'm just like, oh, it's still coming. Whatever. It's just inevitable.
Let me ask you this. If they were going to change the design of the nacelles in this movie, would you want to know ahead of time, or would you want to be surprised?
The design of the nacelles of the Enterprise in the JJ movies is one of the greatest things that they did in those movies. So I would be so upset if they changed those designs. So hopefully that's not the case here. They can change the uniforms all they want. Go ahead. Change away. Leave the nacelles.
Well, we will see what they do. We'll keep our eyes open for any other teasers or spoilers that come out, because again, I don't really mind knowing ahead of time either. And as we go along, maybe we'll have more fun speculating on what the plot of this film is going to be, as we did leading into Darkness, which go back to some of those old Ready Rooms and listen to the news segments, because we had some really crazy ideas about where that movie may have gone at the time before we knew what was actually happening. All right, well, that's all we have in news. Before we go into the feature, I'd like to remind you of a couple of things. Of course, I'd like to thank our associate producers here on the Ready Room, Zachary Frueling, who you will hear in just a moment in the feature, who was also on the show last week, and also the lovely Renee Roberts, who is a huge supporter of the network. You can find Renee on Twitter. Mares_1701 is her username. And of course, you can find Zachary on Twitter as well, and he'll give you that information at the end of the feature. We are a listener-supported network, and we need your help to keep the Ready Room in all of our shows, including Daniel's show Earl Grey, coming every day of the week. And the way you can help us do that is to go to patreon.com/trekfm. All the information that you need to know is right up there. That's patreon.com/trekfm. And I hope you'll go over and support us. Every little bit makes a huge difference for us, and we have a lot of great perks over there for you as well. We really thank you for your support. And lastly, I would like to remind you that The Ready Room and Earl Grey are just two of the many, many shows here on the network, and also Women at Warp, because Jara Hodge is going to be with us coming up. You can find all of our shows if you're an Apple user. If you're an iDevice user, you can go to iTunes.com/TrekFM. That'll take you straight into our artist section. We are a featured provider with Apple and iTunes, and we really thank Apple for that. It's a really easy way for you to find all of our individual shows or get the master feed, which contains every episode of every show that we do, as well as some other things, including the Patrons Roundtable, which is one of the perks that you can be involved in if you support us through Patreon. Again, that's itunes.com/trekfm. And if you're an Android user, you can get the RSS link from our website or use an app like Pocket Casts, whatever you want to listen to, and search Trek FM or search the name of the show, and it'll come up right there. Daniel, you're an Android user, right?
I am. I am indeed, yeah.
What app do you use to listen to podcasts on Android?
So believe it or not, I actually, I am an Android user for my phone. But I actually have an old iPod Classic that I actually listened to so I actually still use, unfortunately, in my opinion, iTunes for. But it's a great way to find the podcasts.
Okay, yeah, there are a number of options there. Also, we're on Spreaker, SoundCloud, TuneIn, Windows Phone. Spreaker has an app for Windows, which is great, and you can listen that way if you happen to be a Windows Phone user. So we're all over the place. And of course, you can always stream from the website. So go check out all the other shows and support everyone here on the network. And we really thank you for listening. Now, let's jump into the feature. We've all heard the expression, selling your soul to the devil. The people of Vintax 2 took this perhaps a bit too literally when nature started getting restless and a con artist with a claim to the planet showed up. Who can save the day? Well, Kirk, of course. I mean, Picard. This is a TNG episode, only it isn't. And today we're going to discuss the unique and fun fourth season episode, Devil's Due. And to help us do that, we're joined once again by Ready Room Associate Producer Zachary Frueling. Welcome back, Zachary.
Thank you very much. This is my third podcast with the network in as many days, and I was joking with you guys on the other side of the room that I've moved my sonic shower and my replicator into my studio, so I'm okay. Good to go. I'm ready to make a Faustian deal with you guys, talking about the Devil's Due on the Ready Room.
All right. Well, I was going to ask you if you ever left, because I thought maybe you just, you know, you had a cot over there and you just stayed in the Ready Room since we talked about the trouble with Tribbles
a couple of days ago.
We're recording these kind of back-to-back, although they'll drop a week apart. All right. Well, good to have you back. And also joining us for the first time in the Ready Room from Women at Warp, it's Jara Hodge. Welcome, Jara.
Hey, thanks. I'm glad to be here to discuss this amazing episode.
Great to have you here. All right. So let's jump in with our synopsis as we usually do. And Daniel, since you are our TNG-er, our Earl Grey guy here, I'm going to ask you to do the synopsis.
Sure. So the Enterprise receives a distress call from a planet like they're one to do, where civil unrest has broken out and people literally think that the sky is falling. It's the end of days in Armageddon. We find out the natives...
Oh, they should have done this as a Chicken Little episode. That would have been...
Yeah, maybe. We find out the natives of the planet made a deal with the devil 1,000 years ago and has come to collect. Fortunately, Picard and the gang are on the case and will try to demask Feklar, Satan, Ardra, whatever you want to call her, and expose her for the fraud that she is.
I feel like this is a Scooby-Doo episode at the end, yeah. Right? Where their Space Mystery Inc. is ripping the mask off.
So at first, like, she's Feklar, and then they walk up to her, and it's like, it's not Feklar, it's Old Man! And then they take it off, and it's really Satan, and like, right. Wait, no, it's not Satan either! It's, yeah.
Don't forget that Troy is one of the masks.
Oh, that's right.
Oh, yeah.
So
that's
random.
True. I'm thinking, it's not Beklar. Argyle?
Yeah.
What are you doing in here?
And then the last mask underneath all of these Russian dolls of masks is obviously Jeffrey Combs.
He is everywhere.
Of course. Naturally. Of course. And no one recognized him. All right. Well, let's talk about our initial thoughts on here, because one thing that we all agreed upon when we were choosing an episode is that this is an episode that we all like, but it's one that I'm not sure is necessarily a big fan favorite, although it was the highest rated TNG episode up to that point, excluding Encounter at Farpoint, which is saying a lot because it's in the fourth season and you have the best of both worlds in there, as well as many other great episodes. Maybe that was just the fact that the show had become more popular at that point. There were just more people watching. But anyway, Jara, what are your first thoughts on this episode?
Well, I would say I would put it maybe in the middle of the pack. I'm not sure I would say I'm a huge fan of it, but there's a lot of fun things in it. I think the biggest barrier for me for really saying I'm a fan of this episode is I just didn't care about the Ventaxians a lot. I was kind of like, don't know why we should care about these people. I felt like Ardra's motives weren't also totally clear in terms of why she just wanted Picard to be her sex slave and that was like her ultimate thing. Don't
so
get me
handsome,
wrong.
You know?
I'm a big Picard fan. I just felt like a bit of the story was underdeveloped. But overall, it's a lot of fun. I enjoy the courtroom scene. I think the actress who plays Ardra does a fabulous job and I enjoy watching it.
Yeah, she does. To interject in the middle of initial thoughts here, what you said about her wanting Picard for herself, do you guys think that could be a holdover from this originally being a script that would have included Kirk?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that this is part that would have worked better with Kirk because I think that Kirk would have been somewhat tempted and that would have added some tension. Whereas it kind of just, if she just was hitting a brick wall with Picard every single time. It would have been really funny if instead of turning into Deanna Troi, though, she had turned into Loxana Troi.
That would have been funny.
That's one of my favorite parts of the episode is how unflappable Picard is, though, like throughout the entire thing. Like, I love that he's just like, I just can't stand this woman. Like, she basically, for most of this episode, is kind of a female Q. And like, he's just having none of it. He just doesn't want anything to do with her. And I think I love that part of it. It's great.
Yeah, I think with Kirk, it would have been a much more stereotypical reaction, right? You know, Kirk gets the girl. That's not a new theme. But with Picard, true. You just get this great straight man reaction that accounts for a lot of the humor in the episode.
Yeah, but I think it undermines some of the tension because you never have any doubt that he's going to unmask her.
Right. Plus, he can't really show any interest in her in that one scene on the bridge because Beverly is standing right next to him. Staring at Ardra the whole time.
Yeah, if Ardra really knew what she was doing, instead of Deanna Troi, she would have turned into Crusher. But,
yes. So are you exactly. Team Beverly or Team Ardra, Chris?
Me? Am I Team Beverly or Team Ardra? For Picard, like if I'm campaigning for... Well, Beverly, yeah, he's supposed to be with Beverly.
Hashtag Team Bev.
All right, so I interrupted in the middle of initial thoughts, so do you have anything to add, Daniel?
This is actually one of those episodes that you don't think about a lot, and maybe, like you were saying, Chris, I don't know if it's because fandom as a whole just kind of doesn't talk about it that much. You know, it's just not really... You don't remember it that often, but it's one episode that I always have fun with. I just watch it for the silliness and the courtroom scene and the kind of dopiness of the episode, because that's kind of a holdover from like the, oh, it was going to be probably going to be a silly TOS episode. Those episodes are great, and it's fun to kind of see that remade in the TNG way, and make some TNG changes to it, but still kind of like have this TOS flip. So like, this is so much better than something like the other one that's often cited as a phase two episode, which is The Child. And
The Child.
Yeah. Oh gosh. Yeah. Agreed 100%.
And then the other real holdover from TOS that comes to mind is The Naked Time. I had to make sure I said the right one there. So this one works infinitely better than both of those. So it's nice to see a good TOS, possible TOS episode made into a good TNG episode, or at least a decent one.
What if in The Child, Deanna gave birth to the child, and it quickly grew up to be Ardra?
Well, that would make the child make more sense in some ways, I guess.
Or more interestingly, Feklar.
Yes.
Then Worf would have been really upset. And then in season 7, when they're dating, Worf would say, yeah, you remember that time that you gave birth to Feklar? I can never forgive you for that. So, all right. Well, how about you, Zachary?
Yeah, you know, last week on the Ready Room, we talked about the trouble with tribbles in the original series. And I think it's kind of a happy accident we're talking about this episode after we talked about that episode. In that episode of the Ready Room, we talked about the fact that the original series was always really good at using humor to get discussion of serious issues across. And I think you can find that here, right? This is a very funny episode. One of my favorites, unlike Daniel, I think this is one of my absolute favorites. When we were looking through the list of episodes to decide what we were going to cover in the Ready Room today, this one jumped right out. It's always been one of my favorites, so I threw it right out there, and I'm glad we're doing it. But you can find these really serious themes, despite the humor. You've got environmentalism. You've got this notion of latent fear and a sort of apocalyptic thinking, kind of an apocalyptic worldview that the Ventaxians have, very relevant for today's world. This contrast between science and mysticism, in terms of the two worldviews that are kind of battling it out in this episode. And frankly, I just think the TNG cast is on fire, right? You know, they've settled into their roles at season 4. They're coming off the success of Best of Both Worlds. And it just strikes me that the characters are having fun. They look relaxed and they know who their characters are at this point.
Humbug, sir. Humbug.
I also like when Picard and Data are standing in the corridor and Data is still in his Scrooge garb there. And there are these ensigns walking by with their pads. And there's this one girl that walks by. And I just picture that they didn't tell her anything about what she was going to see when she turned the corner. And when she came around the bend, I guess, because the corridors are curved. Because she has this little smirk or something. Like she comes around expecting to see Patrick and Brent in their uniforms. And then here's Brent with this gown.
You have to imagine that the corridors surrounding the holodecks must be judgment-free zones. Because right. There are people walking out of those things all the time in weird clothes and stuff. So
it's like, within 100 feet of the entrance to holodeck, anything goes. Yeah. You know, what happens there stays there.
If you see Moriarty, you know something's wrong, though.
Or Wesley throwing a snowball at you.
a feverish snowball that gets you sick and everybody else.
But there's a lot of great little touches of dialogue in this. I mean, just little things like when Geordi walks into the courtroom scene and Data's in his playing judge for this this arbitration, and he just walks up and says, "Hi, Geordi. Hi, Data." the characters are having fun. The actors are having fun.
I was picturing this image outside the holodeck where you see Alexander and Lwaxana in bikini shorts heading in together, and you're like, what the hell's going on here? I'm not even going to ask.
Oh, boy. Or
mud bath time.
Or even better, when they're walking out of the holodeck and they're covered in mud. So,
all right. Well, let's talk more about this as a phase 2 script. And I was going to say a phase 2 TOS script. It wasn't really a TOS script, but it was an idea that Gene Roddenberry had when he was creating the idea of Star Trek in the first place in the 60s to pitch the series and get it on television. I don't know how fleshed out it ever was at that point, but it was actually written as a script for Phase 2, which would have included Kirk in place of Picard. Of course, Spock would not have been in Phase 2. We would have had Zahn instead, although I kind of have a feeling that those characters would have been played very similarly in terms of, because Zahn was a replacement because Leonard Nimoy would not do the show. So I don't think that it would have changed that much early on. Who knows? But when I watched this episode over the years, just as a TNG episode, I just enjoy it as that. But if I watch it, keeping in mind that it was written for other characters and it was written in a TOS style, I really see a lot of similarities. Everything from lines that are spoken, the way some of the characters behave, the musical cues, the way that, you know, like the sit-downs with the manager of the science station there, it just feels very TOS-ish, like something that you would see Kirk doing in them visiting a planet. So, Jara, any thoughts on that feeling? Did you get that feeling at all when you're watching it?
Absolutely. I mean, of course, you know, we got to see False God stories after Roddenberry was off Trek, but that's very much a Roddenberry humanist influence on Trek, is stories about false gods, or in this case false devils, and it's not actually magic, it's science. And I always value that as a story. So that was, I mean, the most obvious thing to me, but you're right about the sort of the feel of it as well. I think Ardra as a character comes across like a lot of the sort of TOS femme fatale villains, like a little bit, you know, she's like very self-possessed. She has these kind of over-the-top lines that she, as the actress, totally owns this. So I love it. Yeah. Like the, "Oh, Picard, I will enjoy you morning, noon, and night."
Right. No, she did such
so
a good job.
It's my favorite line ever.
And then she tells him at the end, "You would have had a lot more fun if you hadn't lost."
She reminds me of the character from Cat's Paw.
Yeah, it kind of makes it makes me feel Sylvia in Cat's Paw. The sort of lacy black stuff is not hurting that comparison. I think it works though. I think you're right that it's definitely the best of those episodes that came from that influence.
Well, and talking about Gene Roddenberry and false devils, this is actually the second time they've revisited this, because you have the Magics of Magus 2 in the animated series where the devil appears, and there's also magic, and the science doesn't work out as well. So this is a recurring theme. How about you, Daniel?
You know, just to jump off real quick of what you said, Jarrah, with that line was so great. And I'm really happy that they literally name drop Q in this episode. Could she be... she could be Q. Who knows? Like that line, I feel like I could see John DeLancey saying to Picard, just a jab at him, and I was like laughing at it the whole time.
Do you think that is part of why Picard disliked her so much? Just the thought that maybe Q is coming and trying to seduce me as a woman, like really made him feel uncomfortable.
It certainly puts him off of the idea of, you know, omnipotent, super powerful beings, I think. So he's already a little biased against her when he first meets her. He's not very impressed.
I got the sense he was more motivated by his usual sort of indignance about more powerful beings duping less powerful or less intelligent, in this case, species. It was very much in character for him. And he got to say some pretty fun lines too, like in the courtroom scene, "Did she not even pick up one piece of trash?"
Right.
And it's said in that like so bombastic Patrick Stewart way. I love that. "One piece of trash." It's so awesome.
But you know, one of the funniest things about the character is just how much she really just disrespects Captain Picard's authority. You know, he's used to being the captain in charge, and at every turn she just refuses to, I mean, she barely acknowledges that he's in a position of authority. I mean, you know, at least even Q will acknowledge him as the captain and take him somewhat seriously in that regard, but she just dismisses him.
A mythical deity, so she cannot
break character. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean she has to take that attitude towards him.
Yeah, and actually if you're looking for motivations for Picard, like you can almost see Patrick Stewart, well, the Picard character, being crushed when she first walks up to him and he's like, "I'm the captain of the Enterprise." And then like before he gets to go on with his monologue, she just walks away and he's like really hurt that nobody wants to listen to him.
Good job, you know, keep up the good work.
Oh, that's nice. Okay, well, I'm going to go over here and take this planet now. And he's like, "Now I don't like you. Now I don't like you at all."
But at the same time, he's so intrigued. You know, she really won ups him in a few places. You know, she transports him to the planet in his pajamas and whatnot. It's an irresistible mystery for him at the same time. So he's sort of intellectually tempted.
But I like how Geordi tries to remain professional. And it's not like, "Captain, what are you doing here in your pajamas?" It's like, "Captain, I wasn't expecting you."
And the way Picard like, says,
"This whole pajama thing, I don't see anything weird going on here, Captain."
"Mr. Worf, make sure he brings a uniform." And it's like,
"Did you say uniform?"
"Okay, sure."
All right. What do you think, Zachary?
Yeah, you know, I was reading through the summary of the original story for Star Trek Phase 2, and it struck me there were just some elements that were sort of unnecessarily complicated. Like, you know, for example, the character that became Ardra, I hope I'm going to pronounce the name correctly, Comethes, is an energy being, you know, in the original story. And the people who do this deal are six philosophers who one of them ends up being this character named Zolar. You can definitely hear this 1970s influence in these character names. changed, by the way.
Now, is that Zolar with an X or a Z?
It's a Z-X-O-L-A-R.
Oh, nice.
Oh, it's a Z-X. Wow.
Get them both in there.
All bases here.
And so one of the characters is 1,000 years old. And you know, it just strikes me as these were elements that needed to be stripped away to get to the heart of the story. And they did a good job with that for the TNG story. And in stripping that away, especially the idea that one of the characters could be 1,000 years old, you end up setting up this sort of multi-generational fear that's passed down. And that becomes one of the more interesting elements of the story. So I think they did the right things with the story. But I think... you know, the thing that really works for this episode for me is the relationship between Captain Picard and Ardra. You know, the humor in Captain Picard's, you know, straight man relationship to the antagonism that she's providing really works for me. And I have a hard time seeing any of the original series cast in that role. Maybe if it were Spock, if it was the original series, or Zahn in Phase 2, it would make sense. But I have a hard time seeing Kirk having the same humorous relationship with the dialogue there.
And of course, in the original concept, Kirk would have been the arbiter, and then the computer, the ship's computer, would have been the judge, because, again, it's impartial. It's like Ardra picking Data to be the arbiter here, because he's not going to be influenced because he's an android. So that makes sense.
Wouldn't the ultimate, like, tragic twist of that be that Kirk would have to talk the Enterprise computer to death?
Oh, yes.
Like, how do I ensure victory for myself? I have to destroy the computer. Oh, you know.
Well, see, Data makes sense, though. At least Data is self-aware. The Enterprise computer, you know, adjudicating something, that doesn't really ring true to me.
Well, I can picture, like, the bug from Tomorrow is Yesterday kicking in as well, so that the judge has this seductive female voice and is in love with Kirk while he's trying to be the arbiter of this dispute. And the computer has to make a rational decision. That would be an interesting twist.
I think McCoy could have played off Ardra.
Oh, I can see that.
That would have been interesting.
It would have been like a lot more hilarious, though, just outright.
I think that would have been it's almost better that we get it as a TNG episode, because a big chunk of the charm of this episode is Data as the judge there. And that's where a lot of the laughs come in, you know, when he's, you can sit down now, sir, you know, sir. And like all of these little lines that he gets. And it's so much fun, because he's like,
My favorite lines are when he says things like, you will refrain from showing personal affection, or you will refrain from making your opponent disappear.
Yeah.
Things like this.
He's just taking it, you know, as it is. It's just Data.
It's a way that a human would never phrase it that way, but for Data, it makes sense to just say it like it is. It comes off so great, such deadpan.
Yeah, when you read those lines in the script, they sound really ridiculous, but Data, you know, owns them and brings them to life.
Do you see some spots where I see Data playing what maybe would have been a Spock role if this had been a TOS episode, or maybe a Zahn role? Especially when they're in Picard's ready room and they're discussing what's happening on the planet and the fear and how that can affect people. Some of the lines that Data has there really feel like that's how Spock, or anyway, a Vulcan, would counter what Picard is saying or what Kirk would have been saying.
I didn't, honestly, Picard's lines captured me a lot more than Data's did, so I don't remember exactly what Data said in that scene. I can see, though, that whole, you know, Picard explaining to him what a flim-flam man is kind of thing. It is really reminiscent of Kirk explaining illogical human stuff to Spock.
Yeah, P.T. Barnum.
Yeah, Data doesn't know, like, some of the most common usage of colloquialisms and stuff, but I know a quote from P.T. Barnum from the 19th century. It's, like, so absurd, but whatever.
I love that they make it sound like the phrase con artist has gone out of style, as if they don't exist in the 24th century.
That's true. That's funny. Even though they meet them a lot.
So, like, Picard says, Data asks Picard, do you believe Ardra is a con artist? And Picard says, I do, Mr. Data. And then Data says, sir, if I may point out, the Ventaxians did have 1,000 years of peace and tranquility, as Ardra promised. This is one of the moments where I feel like that would be the Vulcan position, because it's very logical. Like, they said they were going to have 1,000 years of peace, they had 1,000 years of peace. Therefore, Ardra really has a claim to this planet.
You know,
it's just following the logic behind it.
It's also very reminiscent of a very similar conversation that Data has with Picard in the terrorist episode where they kidnap
High Ground.
Yes, High Ground. Thank you. Beverly. And Data's like, well, hey, terrorism seems to work all the time. Like, it seems to affect change constantly. Like, this is a super effective way of getting things done. And it's like, yeah, I mean, logically, that does make sense. You follow that and things will happen if you do all of these crazy things. But Picard is again playing the role of, no, but this isn't what we do. This is not how we do these things anymore. Like, we've moved past this. So it's kind of reminiscent of that, I think.
That's true. I think, though, that I can hear those words coming out of Spock's mouth from that Ready Room scene, but I don't actually think it's logical because he's confusing correlation with causation. And actually, that is the point where and I'm going like, I can't, this feels weird to me that Picard is more skeptical than Data. And it would feel even weirder if it was Spock to me. And there are some scenes in the courtroom thing, as funny as it is to have Data in that position and have him have some of those great lines where I'm going, this still is super, super far-fetched, and you're giving the benefit of the doubt when, in fact, I don't think that would actually fly under tests of logic or legality.
You could imagine 1,000 other causes for this 1,000 years of peace, and so, you know,
well, that's
I guess
what
I don't
Picard
know.
Brings up. Mm-hmm. You know,
during
he
the
says
trial,
we can only speculate about what occurred on this planet 1,000 years ago.
This entire episode is essentially a causation versus correlation kind of lesson. I mean, that's what it is. And it does stretch the imagination to think that there were 1,000 years of people and nobody thought, you know, we did a lot of this stuff on our own. No, you know, this right. woman didn't help at all. What the heck? She didn't build one road or, you know, reduce whatever at any bit. And so it works as a metaphor, but, you know, as a straight hard science fiction kind of thing, you're like, well.
You know, I'm glad we're talking about this because one thing that struck me is the difference in reaction that Picard and kind of the crew in general, but especially Picard has when they first encounter Q. You don't see this kind of, you know, scientific, let's go see what the wizard is behind the curtain, right? What's making the magic work? You just kind of take it at face value. And, you know, you get something similar with Ardra, except for the fact that, you know, he desperately wants to expose her for a fraud. But they're two very different reactions. And the thing that strikes me about this is the kind of difference in worldview between the sort of the scientific worldview where you go looking for these hidden causes or sort of an enchanted, mystical, you know, religious worldview where you take these things kind of on faith, but you know, there's this latent fear, and I think we all probably know people like this. I know people in my life, some family members even, hope they're not listening. You know, people who they see you know, ghosts or spirits or devils or angels, you know, around every corner, where, you know, the things that happen are kind of enchanted and that's part of their worldview. And it does have this fear. And I think, you know, exposing things for, you know, either exposing things like that as frauds or, you know, finding the hidden causes, you know, it's kind of demystifies the experience and takes away the fear. So I think, you know, Picard wants these people to not be afraid and realize they've improved their own situation a lot, but they've got this, you know, 1,000 years worth of fear that's built up because of this mystical worldview.
Well, I think that it's possible that over the course of this 1,000 years that the whole Ardra story has slipped into being something that people talk about, but they don't really believe. But we don't know what else is happening on the planet. We only see the tremors happening, which are pretty strong tremors, by the way. As someone who lives in a country where we have earthquakes every week, these are large tremors, but they're saying, yeah, it's nothing to be concerned about. You know, it's just a little shake. Just the camera shake when they're in the courtroom.
Yeah, those but buildings anyway, are stable.
I guess so. But it's possible, you know, that it's fallen into that. But as soon as something happens like these tremors, maybe there's something else going on in the society as well that's causing people to become fearful or to be concerned. And so they're turning back towards the story. And then when she actually shows up, suddenly it becomes real again. That it may not be a case that for 1,000 years, everyone has just really thought like, well, thank goodness for Ardra. You know, I mean, Ardra's probably not on their money. You know, she's probably not that much a part of it. But what I find interesting about this story, and you see it all the time in the real world, is that when there's a hardship or disaster or something is threatening our way of life, as it is now, you know, we have a lot of different threats to the way we're accustomed to living, that as a whole, society kind of has a tendency to become more conservative and to turn back towards myths that they find comfort in, the idea that there is something else controlling what's going on. And so that way you can think, well, okay, someone's going to bail us out of this, right? It's not all on us. And this story has a lot of that in it.
Yeah, it's a cautionary tale, right? It's basically the original Ardra, it's a placebo. It's, hey, now there's this solution. Go out and do your thing. And it was, like Picard said, it was the courage and the hard work of those people 1,000 years ago that said, no, we're going to make changes. We're going to change the way that we live. And unfortunately, like what happens in the real world and in this fictional tale is that these people misattribute the results of these actions to something else, something other than. So it kind of removes a level of responsibility that people have when you can just say, well, this is the way it is, or this is the way that people above me say it is, or this is. It's like Picard is like, no, you guys did this yourselves. You should be proud of yourselves and recognize that you have the capability to change and to make a difference. And that's kind of what the core message is, I think, here.
And that's definitely, going back to the original script, that's definitely a message that I would see Kirk delivering to a planet in TOS. Of course, then he would probably blow up their computer and fly away and say, you're on your own now. I hope you're up for it. But that's the idea. I mean, that's the Gene Roddenberry idea, right? That, you know, you have control, you're doing it. And as Jara mentioned up front, you know, don't look to a false guide. It's like, you are controlling your life.
Ardra, stop the tremors if you can.
But you know, they even write this tension into the dialogue between Picard and Ardra, right? Ardra challenges Picard, you know, isn't there enough room in your worldview for magic in the universe? We live in a universe filled with magic, and can't you make room in your worldview for you know, someone the likes of me? And you know, this is a little bit of an anecdote, but I was listening to the radio the other day in the car, and you're going to laugh. Puff the Magic Dragon came on in the car, and it made me a little sad, right? You know, we grow up, and you know, we disenchant the universe around us, right? We go looking for explanations for things rather than just getting wrapped up in the mystery and the magic. And you know, you want just enough magic in the universe where you stay curious and stay hungry and want to get out and keep exploring, right? There's I think part of that in being an explorer on the Enterprise is, you know, getting out of the universe and seeing what's out there. There's going to be something unknown, but Picard immediately wants to kind of demystify everything he encounters. So it strikes me that you want just enough magic where you stay curious and stay an explorer, but not so open to magic and mysticism that you live in this latent fear of it's sort of an apocalyptic thinking, right? The universe is going to end and they're creeping up on this 1,000-year deadline. And I think, you know, the fear is probably a result of this apocalyptic thinking. You know, if you're 100 years away from 1,000 years, you don't have to worry about it very much, right? If you're 5 years away, you're going to worry about it just a little bit more. And I've seen, the result of apocalyptic thinking in people I know. And it does create this fear, this latent anxiety, looking over your shoulder at every turn, you know, afraid of a deity going to smack you down.
Yeah, or even just, you know, susceptibility to charismatic but awful politicians, or
exactly.
People that will play on your fear and be able to offer you what appears to be an easy way out.
Yep.
And you know what else too is that idea is interesting, and you mentioned before was the when she's like, is there no room for magic? Have you not met anybody that can, you know, defy our expectations? And then earlier on in the episode, they have the scene where they mention Q and they talk about Q and like, could this be Q? And Picard's like, well, I don't remember Q ever, you know, signing a contract. I don't remember him ever going for land and all of this stuff. And
economic forecasts.
Yeah. So it's like,
it's not his style.
It's you exactly. It's not a style. So you kind of, I do think that Picard is definitely inherently a skeptic, but he's more skeptical of her motivations initially. That's what really sets him off, is like, why would she care? Why would she want these things? Why is she taking from others to give herself? That's what really, I think, sets him off. And like Jared just mentioned, you know, same whole thing with politicians or deities or whoever. It's like there's ultimately this kind of conflict between those who have and those who don't.
Mm. Yeah, there's alarm bells going off. Yeah.
I'm picturing, Zachary, when you were talking about the apocalyptic thinking earlier, it's just 3 years ago on Earth, of course, we had all the movies about the Mayan calendar in 2012. So I'm picturing Fantaxian theaters at this time. It's a big 3D movie, Ardra in 3D. The world is going to end.
You know, dystopian fiction is huge in their world right now.
Right.
Yeah, I do still wish that we had got a little bit more than just the one super bland Fantaxian guy. I mean, I think it was powerful to spend a lot of time with Picard, who his whole raison d'etre in this episode is to debunk her. And it's cool to put us in that position, but we also need to be able to inhabit the position of the person who's in the apocalyptic thinking so that you can say, you know, what would get you to that point and then how do I avoid it? And I don't think anyone could relate to super boring blue capey guy.
First of all, I like his blue cape, but I agree he is very boring. But one thing that did along those same lines where I kind of was like, was this guy's whole worldview just was mine was blown literally in the courtroom. And 3 seconds later, he's calling the cops on this woman. Like, I feel like you would need like a day to adjust at least to just kind of this whole thing of like, whoa, this woman that I've been, you know, afraid of for 10 years that I've started to talk about in the past 5 years, like, is now a fraud. What does this mean? What is it? And he's like, just to me, that was the one part that I'm like, oh, so he just calls the space cops, you know.
The thing that really works for me, though, the scene in the courtroom when he's being questioned by Ardra and Ardra asks him, is there any doubt in your mind, any doubt whatsoever that I'm who I say I am? And you can see him want to say, I'm starting to have my doubts now, but he's so afraid of the situation. You know, he ends up, you know, very quietly saying, you know, no doubts whatsoever, Ardra. You know, and the actor, I think, did a great job. So there were some good moments from him, even despite his relative blandness.
Well, if he were an Earth politician, I think he would have been thinking, okay, well, I need to get together with Ardra, and then together we can really take over.
You're right.
He would have had more fun with Ardra, yeah.
They were saying, like, people on this planet are committing or about to commit suicide. Like, it's going to take them more than just, you know, that quick demonstration, especially the people who didn't actually see that demonstration but had seen her other demonstrations with their own eyes to sort of come down off that. But, we couldn't fit it all in the episode.
Well, you get people, you know, this is an old story, which I think from the reports I've heard, this one's true, but when Orson Welles did War of the Worlds on the radio, there's reportedly a few people who committed suicide because they thought that the world was about to end and that aliens were invading Earth, Martians were invading Earth. So, and I'm sure around 2012, there probably were a few people as well. And every time there's some, you know, some figure, I don't want to say religious leader because these people are not of any organized religion necessarily. They've got their own little cultish niche. But when they say the world is going to end on a particular day at a particular time, there are always a few people who, you know, sell all their belongings or commit suicide or something to prepare for it. So maybe some Ventaxians were so stirred up by the arrival of Ardra that they would do that. But it's hard for me to imagine that all over the planet, you know, Ventaxians were ready to wipe themselves out because of this.
Well, this is a good question. I mean, we don't really know, but is, you know, once the Ardra event, you know, transpires and it's out of the way and they expose her for a fraud, right? Is this a major crisis of theology for the Ventaxians? Or, you know, is it a week later and they've already moved on, you know, as if they were a few years before she appeared, right? We don't really know. They don't go there. But, you know, I think my experience has been, you know, after, you know, like the guy who was some years ago was, you know, predicting the rapture or the 2012 thing or the Y2K bug, whatever it is, right? A week later and people have already forgotten about it and they moved on. Or is this a deep, worldview crisis for them?
Well, I think that's because in all those situations, there's only a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of the population that's buying into that in the first place. Whereas for it to be a major problem, we would have to know, is Vintaxian theology actually built around Ardra, or is that just an ancient story? Because it's so long ago in their history. You know, it could be. I mean, we have earth religions which are thousands of years old, which still control how society functions on earth. And then we have other earth religions that are older than that, which we now view purely as mythology, and we wouldn't buy into the stories as having any influence on us.
Well, we know that it's at least a deep enough part of the theology where there's at least 40 or 50 iterations of Jeffrey Combs running away from the burning buildings.
Oh, right. I know. I barely recognized him.
He is everywhere.
I love the way that they duped him there, though.
Yeah.
Speaking of that scene, real quick, I feel like the people on the left side, on the lower level, are way smaller than they should be in comparison to the people on the right side up high. I mean, I know that there's a height difference, but not that much. It's kind of a...
They didn't fix that for the Blu-rays?
Well, I was watching the Blu-ray, so... Well, it feels odd to me, but anyway. I guess...
Somebody get Mike Okuda on
the phone
right now.
It's Jeffrey Combs, though, so hey.
You know, comparing it to Earth theology, and, you know, not to get too far into this, because that's not what we do, but... It's like, okay, so Vintaxian society hasn't evolved at all because, first of all, this is a 1,000-year-old legal document that they're pulling legal precedents from, which, like, I guess I can see possibly happening maybe in 700 and whatever years for the Constitution, but at that point, it's going to be so... I'm just saying, for over 1,000 years is a long time for them just to look at this document and be like, it's completely legally binding and there's never been anything right. in 1,000 years mm-hmm. that has ever poked a hole in it. And it, like... Okay. See, I don't know. You can really dive really deep into, like, what don't we know about this society and what does it mean? What does this mean for these people? But really, that's kind of not the point. It's obviously more about Ardra or the right. woman, I guess. We never even learned her real name, I suppose. But the woman that plays Ardra and what she's doing to exploit these people.
Well, we've talked a lot already about Picard and Ardra's relationship. Is there anything else that stands out to you guys? One thing with the scene of her being in his quarters in her gown and all reminds me of when Q goes and tries to seduce Janeway.
That scene is actually, I was thinking about it. It is a mix of that scene from Voyager, as well as the scene from X-Men 2, I want to say, where Mystique turns into all of the people that Wolverine wants to sleep with. So it's kind of a mixture of those things in my head. It's a scene that might work for Kirk. It's just not what Picard is. That's not like she like instantly becomes enraptured with Picard and thinks that she can seduce him. Then becomes Troy, which is really creepy to me because that kind of feels like a father-daughter-ish relationship, mm-hmm. Much more paternal than sexual in any way.
It kind of felt just like they were like, oh, we need to put Marina in another scene in this episode. right. We never know what to do with her. Let's make her this person's embodiment. It was a little, like, it felt weird, but I love her, like, Ardra's Cher outfit when she first comes in.
It actually reminds me of, I don't know if you guys are wrestling fans, but it reminds me of Sensational Sherry from back in the day. Anyone familiar?
I did not know her, but you showed me the picture of her. And yeah, there's some similarity in the way the makeup is done. Yeah.
If you're listening right now and you don't know who Sensational Sherry is, Google a picture and you'll see the resemblance.
So how do you spell Sherry?
It's with an I, Sherri.
Okay.
She also does the Victorian woman thing, like, oh, if you don't like sexy Cher, maybe you like this Victorian lady.
She's very chaste, so it's okay.
That's the most realistic.
Right.
Of the bunch,
this is where Q went wrong on Voyager. Q should have appeared as a Victorian woman in Janeway's quarters. And then she would have been really interested. But with Ardra here, I'm thinking the whole time, like you said, she comes in thinking I can just seduce Picard. And I'm thinking, like, who do you think you are? Vash? Only Vash can seduce Picard.
And it's like, but it's seriously, like, when she transforms into Troy, it's like, hey, we actually have a major character on this show that Picard is romantically interested in. Why?
I know.
I mean, I know Ardra doesn't know that, I guess, to be fair, to the plot of the story, but it's like, I don't know. It's just creepy to me. I just got creeps when she was like touching his stomach, and I'm like, no, don't do that. Don't do that.
Yeah, as the viewer, it should have been Beverly. Yeah, if it's someone.
I couldn't tell also whether it was supposed to be just funny that it was Troy or whether it was supposed to be telling us that, like, that some very dark back part of Picard's mind might actually go that way. Like, it seemed like, why is this even here? Yeah.
Yeah. I think what you said, they need to put Troy in another scene and say,
yeah.
What if it had been Guinan instead?
Oh my gosh, yes.
Would she be
wearing?
They've
known each other longer than Picard's known anyone else on the crew, you know.
Would she be wearing the same outfit? Except with a giant hat? Like with a giant,
giant hat, yeah. So, and you can snap your fingers and then the hat changes.
I can make my hat into whatever you want.
And if she had done the Victorian woman with a British accent and a posse of little Victorian children and a Christmas tree, it could have worked.
Oh, yeah.
It could have been part of the Janeway Goes Goth arc in Voyager.
Yeah. I wasn't sure if you were going for the cucumber sandwiches there or you were going for the Generations Christmas dinner. So
I was going for Generations, but cucumber sandwiches, don't ever underestimate the power of cucumber sandwiches.
I think that's actually the title of an episode of The Ready Room. I think it's Don't Diss the Cucumber Sandwiches.
Yes.
I do like all of her like get-ups that she gets in, though. Like, all of her outfits are awesome.
Amazing.
She pulls out all the stops for sure.
Yeah.
She has better fashion taste than Sylvia did, I have to say. Because Sylvia had some nice outfits in Cat's Paw, but she had a couple of like, are you sure you want to be wearing that? Kind of like shiny 60s space. There's one in particular that I remember.
Are these outfits possibly the reason that this was the most viewed episode of The Next Generation?
You know, in today's world where you can watch everything on demand, I would say maybe. But back then, you had to watch it when it came on, so no one knew ahead of time. And the teaser on the Blu-ray, did you watch it with the original teaser that they played during the week prior to the episode? And it's always like, a duel with the devil on the next Star Trek, The Next Generation. Although I will say TNG's teasers were a little bit better than Voyager's at actually having something to do with what the story was really about.
Yeah. Agreed.
I love that. I love when it's like totally unrelated to the episode at all. And you're like, you didn't watch this, did you? You have no idea what's going on.
They're like, hey, announcer guy. Go write a script for the teaser.
Like, The Rock is in it. That's all you need to know.
To be fair, that's literally all you need to know about that episode. I mean, The Rock is in that episode. That's all you need.
It took me so much restraint because last week I actually interviewed Dwayne Johnson because the movie San Andreas is opening in Japan. And I only had 15 minutes and I was doing it with Warner Brothers, so I had to be really focused. But I wanted to ask him so much about, remember that time 20 years ago when you were on Voyager? What was that like? But I couldn't say anything. So
that would have been awesome. Did you? Oh my, Chris, days. Did you record a bumper for To the Journey? You should have.
I wish I could have. Like, if I hadn't been going through Warner Brothers, I would have. But,
hi,
you know, I
hi,
have, like,
I'm Dwayne The Rock Johnson, and you're listening to Trek FM. Like, how awesome would that have been?
You're fighting aliens with me on Trek FM. All right. Anything else about Picard and Ardra you want to throw out there?
Any well, you know, in your notes you sent out, Chris, you know, one question you asked was whether we think Ardra is genuinely attracted to Picard or is Picard more of just her plaything, just, you know, a toy that she can use in the course of the episode. I don't think it's really clear. I mean, Picard clearly is not interested, right? He's not going there, even despite the Victorian costume and the Troy outfit, which is a little disturbing. You know, what is Ardra's genuine interest in Picard?
I think she's attracted to him. I don't know. What's your read on that, Jara?
I can't tell either. I think that we're meant to think she's attracted to him because otherwise it doesn't totally make sense why she wouldn't just move on. Or, you know, she puts up a pretty impressive fight basically when she would already have everything else except for his willing submission. So I think we're meant to think that she's attracted to him, but I didn't actually think that that manifested very well. I think she comes across more as treating him like a plaything.
Feels more like a contest, like she's going to try to get him no matter what, and it's not going very well, and that makes her try even harder.
I actually have a theory about this. The opening of the episode is Picard and Data talking about acting, and Data's talking about method acting, right, where you don't break out of the character and you kind of maintain that the entire way through. Well, if you kind of view Ardra's motivations throughout the episode, you're right. Like, why would she care? This woman is about to win an entire planet, and why would she care about Picard at all? But I feel like she's in this role, and she's sticking in the role, and Picard is the one thing. She's an entire planet of willing people ready to do her bidding at any point. And now Picard's the only one that is like, nope, 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 nope. And so I think she's just like, her mindset is like, I have to actually have this now. I have to. That's why she's like, mind, body, and soul, Picard. Willingly, you have to give it to me. And I think that's probably where that came from.
Well, I thought the mind, body, and soul part was still her playing her role of being the devil.
Yeah, of course, yeah. But that's what I'm saying. Like, she's in that role. She's in the role of Feklar. I like to say Feklar a lot, so I'm just probably
Picard in a dream.
We could name this episode Feklar, Feklar, Feklar. Just for Daniel.
In agreeing to do the arbitration, Picard is risking a lot because Picard basically agrees to her terms, right? You can have the Enterprise. You can have, you know, I'll agree to your terms willingly if I lose.
Picard knows he's going to win in the end, though. I don't think he's risking very much.
I mean, you know, for some reason in this episode too, I was reminded of the, and I hope I'm not going too, this is mainstream enough, the Futurama episode where Bender goes to robot hell and he has to play a golden fiddle, or has to win the golden fiddle from the robot devil. And that's just what I kept thinking of. But yeah, he's essentially signing up to lose his soul at that point. So essentially whatever that is in the Star Trek universe, even though. Because he's like, I guess Ardra is everybody's devil. She's like, devil? That's not a word I've heard in a long time. Like, what was that line about? I don't know.
She's everybody's devil. She's the Jeffrey Combs of devils. I also think, I feel like by the end, though, she's really attracted to Picard. Because, you know, in the short term, opposites attract. And the fact that he's so skeptical, I think maybe it intrigues her, and she's kind of finding that a bit attractive in that moment.
But even in the, you know, to get back to the method acting thing, you know, even after she's exposed, she doesn't break character. You know, her final moment is leaving the room, you know, with this cackling laugh that she's had throughout the episode. She's still in character even as she's exposed,
which is very TOS-y, right? It's a TOS element, like, and if only. I really, really wanted to see more. Honestly, yeah. Like, if we had got, like, she's like, I'll see you again, Captain Picard. And like, yes, please. Yes, come back. It would be so much fun if she broke out of jail or space jail or whatever. And
Says, until we meet again, right?
Yeah.
We needed a good scene at the end of this, though, where they all go back on the bridge and have a good laugh.
Yeah.
That would have made it perfectly TOS.
Yeah. I think one of the reasons that I never thought that Picard was actually going to lose the case, other than that, you know, that the next episode he has to be the captain again, is that no one ever tries to talk him out of it. Like, Riker isn't like, Captain, you really shouldn't do this deal. Everyone's kind of like, yeah, you're going to win this case. It's fine. Except like Data tries a little bit, but it never seemed like the stakes were really that high.
Right. We didn't really talk too much about the connection between the opening scene on the holodeck and how it sets up the episode and the fact that they even come back to it when they're having the discussion in the ready room. I thought that was kind of nice because it's an opening scene where you're like, okay, what's going on here? Mm-hmm. And sometimes they do those scenes where they don't have a lot to do with the episode or it's not as intertwined with the story just because they like to play on the holodeck and they like to dress up. But this one, It sets up well, you know, the idea of fear. And Data has the line, I have no emotional awareness to create a performance. I am attempting to use performance to create emotional awareness. And that's exactly what Ardra's doing throughout the episode, is she's using performance to create emotional awareness among the Ventaxians.
I really like the way this initial scene ties in. I mean, it ties in, of course, with the fear element and the conversation in the ready room, but it's also about theater, right? I mean, the thing that's fun about this trial is it's dueling theater, right? Ardra's got her magic tricks and Picard comes along, and it's not enough just to win the argument, right? Picard clearly has logic and reason on his side. He has to do it with some dramatic flair, and it feels like Picard himself, you know, loves the theatrical aspect of being able to one-up Ardra on this one.
Mm-hmm. Well, he gets to be Q for a moment.
He loves to snap his fingers. Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree totally. Like it's so fun, and of course, because it's Patrick Stewart, they're gonna capitalize on. Why would you not capitalize on having Patrick Stewart, right? So this has that scene, like we mentioned before, the line where he's like, "Did you not pick up one piece of trash?" is like so reminiscent of Deja Q, right? Where he's on the bridge spewing Shakespeare to Lwaxana, and it's like. I love it when Picard just gets to just let loose and just be bombastic and big and dramatic, and it's so, so much fun when they let him do that.
You know, when Picard turns into Feklar, I just picture Patrick Stewart, you know, behind the scenes saying, you know, Feklar of Klingon.
And then in the beginning scene too, Chris, like what you were just talking about, is actually kind of a foreshadowing, I guess, because this is much later, but of the... of the episode, oh boy. See, I'm terrible, by the way, this all of the listeners to Earl Grey will know I'm terrible with episode titles. But the one, Emergence, where the Enterprise becomes alive, and in the beginning, Picard is coaching Data on his acting in the same way in this episode. He's talking, I think it's...
Henry V.
And so this is like kind of establishing that kind of relationship, which is really interesting, of... Patrick Stewart being a Shakespearean, or not Shakespearean, but an acting coach to Brent. But mm-hmm. it's fun. And like you said, it ties in so well thematically to the rest of the episode.
Mm-hmm. But it doesn't go too far. It doesn't feel super contrived. So I think it works well. Right.
Yeah. You mentioned Feklar of Klingon. This episode predates The Undiscovered Country by about 8 months. And The Undiscovered Country is the first time they use the name Kronos as the Klingon homeworld. And so here they're still calling the Klingon homeworld Klingon.
Interesting.
Which is a really, if you go back and watch the beginning of TNG, obviously the first four seasons, really weird because Worf will be like, yes, back on the homeworld, the Klingon homeworld. And it's like,
right.
You guys just come up with a name.
Like the Klingons, they don't have a name for their planet. We just call it the homeworld. Yeah. All right. So, well, we're heading into an hour here. So let's wrap up with our final thoughts and our ratings. So, Zachary, what are your final thoughts on this and what rating are you going to give it?
Yeah, you know, I don't have much that I haven't already said, but I think this is one of my most favorite TNG episodes from season four, at least. Like I said, I keep going back to this one. You know, as much as I love the serious issues, I just love the humor in this episode. And they use the humor to talk about some serious issues that we've talked about here. I feel like the TNG cast that were in this episode, not all of them were, but the cast that were in here were just on top of their game. Data's brilliant. Brent Spiner, Patrick Stewart's brilliant in this. Even the little touches like Geordi coming in to, you know, casually say hi to Data and they have this little moment together. Just brilliant acting. A fun episode. You know, there's nothing not to like about this one. So I'm going to give this 9.5 Disappearing Enterprises.
Excellent. But not a light year away, because I don't think Ardra has the ability to transport the Enterprise a light year away.
Right where they are. Yep.
All right. How about you, Ajara?
I wanted to say that I think that Ardra is one of the cooler con artist characters we get to see in mm-hmm. all of Star Trek. And she is, I think, also a pretty cool woman villain. Seduction is only one of many tools in her bag. She's evidently super smart mm-hmm. and good at gaming people and acting. And I agree. I wish we had got to see more of her. So I am going to rate this episode, I'm going to say 6 Ebenezer Scrooge sleeping hats.
Excellent. How about you, Daniel?
Yeah, this is just a fun episode. Like seasons 3 through 6 to me, like I'm a TNG guy. That is Star Trek for me. Like, that is like the peak of like amazing Star Trek stories that are so much fun and just, you're going to have a good time. And this episode is a lot of fun and also has lots of important things to talk about. And I really wish, really, really wish we had gotten to see Ardra again. Come on, we could have traded 1,000 episodes. We could have traded. Let's just trade Sub Rosa. I'll do it right now, retroactively. Let's just trade Sub Rosa, and we'll get another Ardra story. That would be amazing. But you're going to have a good time watching this episode. It's a lot of fun. And if you'll indulge me, I am going to rate it 1 bit of undigested beef, 1 blot of mustard, 1 crumb of cheese, and 1 fragment of underdone potato.
All right. That might be the best rating ever on the review.
That was a method acting rating.
All right. Well, yeah, I've always enjoyed this episode, and it's one that I think fans often overlook. And Daniel, you and I had the same experience pulling out the discs to watch this, thinking that this is a season 3 episode, not finding it there, and then thinking, is it a season 2 episode? It's not a season 2 episode. No, it's a season 4 episode, because it just kind of gets, like, you know, it's in there somewhere, but because it's not one of those episodes that really stands out as, you know, your top 20 list of TNG episodes everyone must watch, it kind of gets lost in the mix there. But I've always enjoyed it, and I really encourage people to watch it as a TOS episode just to find the spots. One thing, I don't think we mentioned it here in the discussion, we did on the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
Is that when Picard walks onto the bridge and finds Ardra sitting in his chair, there's a musical cue that feels very much like something you would have seen on the original series with Kirk walking in and finding something unusual. And I thought that was cool. And I also thought that when Picard says, "I refuse to abandon this planet to that woman," sounded exactly like something Kirk would have said, even all the way down to the inflection that Patrick Stewart used when he said it. So I encourage people to watch it that way. But yeah, just a really fun episode. This was one years ago, I used to always put TNG on when I was going to sleep. This was still in the 90s, but I had them all recorded on VHS. And this is probably one of the episodes I stick in the most often, just because it's just one of the most fun episodes. So I'm going to give this one an enormous surge in Z particles.
Can I say it real quick, how awesome it would have been if, like Kirk, when Kirk sat on his chair and there was a tribble, Picard didn't notice Ardra and then just sat on her while she was in the chair, and all, she's like, "Hey, whoa, hey, hang on." Like, that would have been pretty fun.
Can I say I'm really surprised no one rated the episode in Feklars?
I was going to give it a flim flam, but I decided against it.
So. I had Ventaxian scrolls down.
But. Can I maybe switch my note for, I'm going to give this a rating of 1 Feklar, because you only need 1 Feklar.
That's right. And Feklar kind of made Worf a little bit uncomfortable.
He definitely did. Yeah. I mean, to be fair, everything makes Worf uncomfortable, but yeah, it made him extra uncomfortable.
Well, nothing makes Worf more uncomfortable than having to do a candle ceremony with Jeremy Astor.
Or like relate to his own son.
Right.
Or talk, or be in the same room with his own son. That's pretty uncomfortable, yeah.
Yeah. All right. So thanks for joining us today, guys. Before we let you go, tell everyone where they can find you around the interwebs. So Zachary, where can people find you?
Absolutely. Occasionally, you can find me here on the Ready Room. You can find me on Facebook in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's user listeners user group. You can also find me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, Zachary Fruhling. That's ZacharyFruhling.
Awesome. Thank you. And Jara, where can people find you?
You can find me on the Women at Warp podcast, as well as at trekkiefeminist.tumblr.com.
Awesome. Our hosting company, as of course all of you guys know, and many people know, is Libsyn. And I sent Rob and Elsie at Libsyn a message about a week ago about all of our Parsec Award nominations. And they talked about it on the latest episode of the show. So people go, the show's called The Feed. And maybe you search like The Feed, a Libsyn podcast, and you'll find it. But anyway, Jara, at the end, Rob was reading the names of the shows, and then he said, "Women at Warp." And he said, "Which is just a really cool name for a show."
Okay.
And congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, congratulations. Got about a week to go until we find out who wins. So for those listening who don't know, this show is nominated. Well, all of our shows were nominated. This show is a finalist. Women at Warp is Literary Treks, Continuing Mission, The 602 Club, and Axanar. So we have a lot of them in the mix there, and those awards are at DragonCon. So we'll see how we do. All right. Well, thanks again, guys.
Thanks, everyone.
Wow, Chris, that was so much fun talking with Zachary and Jara and you about Devil's Due, one of my most underappreciated gems in TNG. I love talking TNG. You know this, obviously. And it was so much fun to get different perspectives on it.
Yeah, definitely. When we looked at the list of what we've covered already on the Ready Room, I was a little surprised that we had never done this one just because I like it so much. And I tend to choose, obviously, the episodes that I like to cover on the show. But then again, I usually don't choose the episodes on the Ready Room myself. I don't know if listeners know that. I usually ask my guests to suggest three episodes that they're interested in, and then we figure out which one we're all interested in, and then that's the one we do. And so this one had never come up, but it was a really great discussion. I'm glad we got to do this one. We're doing a lot of good ones recently. The Trouble with Tribbles, got Devil's Due here. Not sure what we're going to do for DS9 yet next week, but it'll be something great. Well, if you'd like to share your feedback on Devil's Due or on the Star Trek Encyclopedia, or whether or not you think Star Trek Beyond is going to feature a young Borg queen or the offspring of the aliens from Let That Be Your Last Battlefield, you can get in touch with us in a number of ways, and we would love to hear from you. You can go to Twitter. Our username is TrekFM. On Facebook, our main page is facebook.com/TrekFM. But we also have a listeners group there, which I'll tell you about in a moment. And you can send us email if you prefer to do that. Go to trek.fm/contact and use the form there. Choose to send to the Ready Room, and that'll come to me by email. You could even send us a voicemail if you like. Go to speakpipe.com/TrekFM. And just use the mic on your computer or your smartphone or your tablet, and you can record a message and upload it to us there from the page. Now, I mentioned Facebook, and our listeners group is called the Babel Conference. It is a closed group. It's a great place to have discussions, though. You just need to go there and click join, and we'll let you in. Daniel, can you tell everyone a little bit about the Babel Conference?
The Babel Conference is amazing. Honestly, it's one of the only of a handful of Facebook groups that I'm a part of, because everybody is respectful. Everybody wants to just have a conversation, and everybody understands that it's infinite diversity and infinite combinations. This is a Star Trek edict, and we all understand that, and everybody's respectful of everybody else. And honestly, sometimes we talk about some controversial things, but it's respect which drives this, our community, I feel like. And I've never been in a position where I've thought, that's a little much. You know, I just, it's just always just kind of, oh, well, I see it from this point of view, and you might see it from this point of view, but we can, like all of our favorite Star Trek characters, we can coexist and live in this world. It just kind of encapsulates a lot of the Star Trek worldview in a Facebook group, which is almost seems impossible.
Right. It does, true. Right? I know. Yeah, I don't go to a lot of Facebook groups because I read the threads and I'm like, okay, I cannot invest my time in this discussion because it's going down a path that I can't go down. But in the Babel Conference, yeah, the discussions are great. And now, last night, we discussed Alf in a dress. Now, is that one of the controversial things that you're talking about that pop up from time to time?
I didn't want to bring it up, Chris, but, you know, my Alf is never in a dress. No, I'm just kidding. I literally don't care at all. But you know, it's always fun. It's always a good time, and everyone is always welcome. And that's the important thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So the way you get there is to type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or on our website, click discussion, and that'll take you there. Just click join, and we'll let you right in. And I hope you'll come join the almost 800 people who are currently in that group. So we've got a nice little pool going there and great discussion. Now, Daniel, when you're not, you know, trying to figure out how all of Ardra's magic works, where can people find you?
Yeah, they can find me, as previously mentioned on the show, but seriously, if you guys like TNG, listen to Earl Grey, Trek FM's TNG-centered podcast. Me with my co-host Philip and Darren, we have this kind of fun every week. We enjoy talking about all of the kinds of things TNG and TNG-related, and it's just a good time. If you want to reach me personally, you can find me on Twitter. My handle there is 1UpDan. That's the number one, not the word, and everyone is welcome. Come on and talk to me about how much you love Ardra, because I love Ardra as well.
Go talk to Daniel about how much you love Nacelles.
Yes, please.
Yes.
All right, Chris. And I mean, you are everywhere, but if people need to get a hold of you, how are they going to do that?
Well, social media is the easiest way to get a hold of me, of course. I'm on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. That's also my name on Facebook, and I'm in the Babel Conference, so I'd love to talk to you over there. And I have my own website, cbrianjones.com, where I attempt to write about things other than Star Trek, so you can check that out. And elsewhere on the network, you can find me with Matthew Rushing on The Orb, which is our dedicated Deep Space Nine show, and we're talking all things DS9 on there. Currently, we're doing a series on the Circle Trilogy, which kicked off season 2 of DS9. And then you can also find me from time to time doing Hyperchannel, and I produce the official Axanar podcast as well. And then you can find my writing about Star Trek on the official website at StarTrek.com. My column there is called Trekspectives, and at the moment that we're recording this, the column that's out is about The Next Generation, Daniel, and using 3 episode arcs to retell some of TNG's key stories, which is something that I'd love to see personally. I think it's a fine idea. And then beyond Star Trek, you can find me on another podcast that I do that's tied into my magazine that I manage here in Tokyo. That's called Metropolis On Air. And on that show, I do a lot of interviews, and we also talk about life in Tokyo and Japanese culture, some Japanese language tips, all kinds of things on there. It's an interesting show. It's very different than the stuff I do here on Trek FM. So if you like to hear me talk, go check that out. Just search Metropolis On Air in iTunes or go to metropolisjapan.com. And if you don't see it on the front page, just type podcast in the search field and it'll come up. And I do hope you'll check that out as well. So I'd also like to once again thank Zachary Fruling and Renee Roberts for their support of the Ready Room here as associate producers, and all of our patrons who help us keep the show going. Please head over to patreon.com/trekfm, patreon.com/trekfm, and find out how you can help us keep the network going. We do need your support. And lastly, I just encourage everyone to check out all the other great shows here on the network. So Daniel, I'm going to beam back down to Vintax 2 because I hear that Ardra in 3D is still playing, and I haven't seen it yet, and I've got to see that before we leave orbit.
All right, Chris, that sounds good, because it's already time to stick a flim in the flam, because this Ready Room is done.